Support for WABE comes from the Community Foundation for Greater Atlanta. You can go beyond giving to impact. Learn more at cfgreateratlanta.org.
I'm Earlonne Woods.
I'm Nigel Poor. We're the hosts and creators of Ear Hustle from PRX's Radiotopia.
Ear Hustle is a show about life inside prison, but it's not your typical prison podcast.
In this next season, we've got stories about the objects people keep inside their prison cells.
About residents in a women's prison who say they want to stay there.
And the most beautiful prison garden. Earlonne, I will never forget it.
Ear Hustle. Stories about life on the inside, told by those who live it.
Find Ear Hustle wherever you get your podcasts.
From WABE in Atlanta, welcome to this edition of Closer Look. I'm Rose Scott, who apparently needs some water. Coming up on today's program, it was an 11-4 vote from Atlanta City Council approving millions for the Public Safety Training Center. Matt Westmoreland, who voted in favor of the legislation, holds the post to at-large seat on the council. He joins me a little later in the program to talk all about it. And in related news, you'll recall three members of the Atlanta Solidarity Fund were recently arrested. Now, they say the charity fraud charges are politically motivated and tied to protesting that training center. In just a moment, I'll speak with Marlon Scott Couts about it. And also later, why it took decades for the city of Doraville to finally allow public art. Those conversations coming up. But first this, today's Fulton County Commission meeting included the nomination of two Republicans to the county's election board, most notably Jason Frazier, who has challenged nearly the registration of about 10,000 folks in Fulton County. And according to the AJC a while ago, only 160 registrations were actually removed by the county election board and about 6,400 registrations put in challenge or, quote, pending status until voters could verify their addresses. It wasn't hundreds that signed up for the public comment during today's meeting, but about 50, and mostly wearing buttons with the words raised right in support of the GOP nominees. And most were from North Fulton County, like Jamie Parrish.
Over the last few months, I have paid attention, and what I've found is a group of elected individuals, adults, who sit in a room and call people names like Karen, and for taxpayers like me and many people in this room to keep our white privilege north of I-20, I suggest that people who say we should keep our white privilege north of I-20 to maybe pass an ordinance where we keep our tax money north of I-20.
And there were those who were opposed to Frazier's nomination, including Stephanie Ali, who's with the New Georgia Project Action Fund, a voter registration nonprofit.
Part of the work of the Fulton County Board is around building the trust for voters, ensuring that voters feel like the county is doing the right, is doing the work, that they have an accurate and equal access to the ballot. And Mr. Frazier is doing the opposite. We've heard differing numbers about how many people has he challenged, and why is that? Because he brags about challenging 20,000 or more people when numbers have shown that he's actually challenged 9,000. Why does he want it to be more? Because he wants to make it look like Fulton is worse at their job.
Now we'll have more on the outcome later today during All Things Considered. This is Closer Look. We're back in a moment.
Support for WABE comes from the Community Foundation for Greater Atlanta. If you love Atlanta, you can invest in the big picture. Learn more at cfgreateratlanta.org. Support comes from Grady Health Foundation, presenting Move for Grady Saturday, April 27th, featuring a family-friendly bike ride through Atlanta's in-town neighborhoods. There's a ride, run, or walk distance for everyone, benefiting Grady Health System. More at moveforgrady.com.
And Closer Look continues here on 90.1 WABE in Atlanta. I'm Rose Scott. Three members of the Atlanta Solidarity Fund were recently arrested during a multi-agency raid on a house they were all living in. Now, the members say, and others say, the charity fraud charges are politically motivated and tied to actually protesting that Public Safety Training Center, which if you don't know about, then I don't know where you've been. In granting bond for the three, DeKalb County Judge James Altman cited, quote, it's a lack of compelling evidence, adding that it's not a lot of meat on the bones. I don't find it real impressive. Now, one of those members who were arrested joins me now. His name is Marlon Couts, Marlon Scott Couts, no relation. Marlon, welcome to the program.
Hello, thank you for having me.
I appreciate it. Listen, before we get into last week's raid and arrest, let's start with some background for those who are not familiar with what the Atlanta Solidarity Fund is all about. Take time to tell them.
Definitely. So the Atlanta Solidarity Fund is an anti-repression and civil rights organization. We are dedicated to protecting the right to protest in Atlanta. And we've been doing this work since 2016. And really what it looks like is ensuring that when protesters are targeted for arrest or participating in social movements, that they have two main things. One, that they have access to assistance getting bailed out of jail if they're unable to afford it, particularly for protesters who may be people of color, who don't have access to generational wealth. And then the second piece is making sure that those protesters have access to legal representation to make sure that their rights are protected and they're able to defend themselves in court against charges that may be politically motivated against them.
And Marlon, this is a nonprofit.
Absolutely. Yeah. It's a IRS recognized 501c3 nonprofit.
So you're a nonprofit, and at the core of your mission, what you all do is to provide funding if needed for folks who might have been arrested or some type of legal counseling or representation. That is solely what you all do.
Yeah. Well, and our nonprofit organization, which sponsors the Atlanta Solidarity Fund, also supports a number of other mutual aid projects throughout the city. Including Food for Life, which is a project which distributes several tons of fresh produce to poor communities throughout the city every week. And I bring this up only to note that the charges that have been brought against our organization have had an impact on more than just our work with the Solidarity Fund, but also access to needed resources for thousands of families throughout the city.
And how are you all funded primarily? Is this through private donations?
Yeah, we're crowdfunded almost entirely, though we do receive some modest grants.
Modest grants. Are those grants either from other nonprofits or any political action funds?
Largely from nonprofit foundations, which support the type of work that we do.
Okay.
But the bulk of our funding comes from crowdsourced funding from ordinary people contributing $20 a month or $50 here and there.
What's your operating budget usually hover around?
Well, I'll tell you, in the past 2 years, our operating budget has been much larger than we expected due to the repression against Top City protesters. And the amount of money that we've gotten in has been not nearly as much as the amount that we've had to expend. And the key reason for that is the extremely high bails that have been set for activists who've been arrested in connection with the Stop Cop City movement. We're talking unprecedented, extraordinary bails. Several bails have exceeded $300,000 for one individual.
Which normally it's 10% you have to pay, right? Normally it's 10% for the bond to be that has to be met, right? Is that correct?
Well, the Atlanta Solidarity Fund posts the bails in full for a variety of reasons. Bonding agencies are often very detrimental to the well-being of defendants. And so we've had massive outlays, I guess, is what I'm trying to say in terms of expenses. And just to put that in perspective, you know, those numbers, because when you get up into the hundreds of thousands, it can seem kind of hard to think through.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, the 390,000 bail that has been set for, you know, a single activist arrested for protesting Cop City, that's higher than the bail of the officers who were arrested for murdering Tyree Nichols.
So
these are police officers who were on camera committing murder.
Sure.
They were given lower bails than the activists in these cases. So there's just been a tremendous financial burden.
So this
us.
Is up into the hundreds of thousands. Is it, does it Is it above 500,000 in terms of what you all, let's say the last year?
The last year has been easily over $500,000 in expenditures.
Marlon, take us back to the morning of the raid and the arrest and what you can share. What happened? What were you doing?
Well, I'll tell you, it was one of the most terrifying experiences I've ever been through. Police broke down my front door while I was sleeping with a battering ram. And I awoke to discover dozens of SWAT officers surrounding my home. When I woke up, my first thought was this must be some kind of mistake. Like this kind of thing couldn't possibly happen to somebody who does the kind of organizing that I do. But pretty quickly realized when I saw the assault weapons and the riot shields, and I heard officers planning to throw a flashbang grenade into my living room. I pretty quickly realized that they had come prepared to shoot and potentially kill. And so we quickly, peacefully surrendered. We were arrested and taken to the DeKalb County Jail in our pajamas, where we were held for the next 4 days.
So weapons were drawn, aimed at you?
Yes.
At what point was there an indication that you all were being arrested? The officers identified themselves, obviously, I'm assuming.
Well, we were never given any explanation of what was happening to us. Officers never provided their identification. We were never shown a warrant an arrest warrant or anything like that. Those things we only discovered later when talking to our attorney in jail. I think to give a little bit of analysis, it seems pretty clear that this raid was deliberately over the top, right? It was intended as a show of force. It was intended to be intimidating and terrorizing to both us and other people who depend on our support in activist movements, to show that anybody who provides support for activists, anybody who assists protesters who are involved in the movement against Cop City, is in danger.
Marlon, I want to read something here from your arrest warrant here, which states that because you all are part, you fund the actions in part, according to this, of Defend the Atlanta Forest, a group classified by the United States Department of Homeland Security as domestic violent extremists. Said group has publicly claimed responsibility for numerous acts while stating their intent was to intimidate employees of the government and private companies into not accepting or completing tasks in and around the site of the Atlanta Police Training Center. Marlon, has your organization provided funding to groups that you know of have been destroying or been taking part in actions, violent actions, as it relates to this training center?
Of course not. And it's worse than that even. Not only are we innocent of the charges that have been presented, the prosecution knows that we're innocent of these charges. And that's evident from looking at the arrest warrants and the statements that have been made in court. They're so flimsy as to be laughable. And unfortunately, my lawyer has been very forceful with me that I am not allowed to discuss the particulars of the warrant or the particulars of ongoing litigation. But we can see, as you mentioned earlier, even the first judge to look at these cases during the first bond hearing acknowledged straight away that he was not impressed by the allegation, that there wasn't a lot of meat on these bones. It's pretty clear to anybody who looks at this that these charges aren't backed by evidence. They're backed by politics. These charges are...
Go ahead. I'll let you finish.
Well, I just think it's really critical, to understand the situation without feeling like you're crazy. You have to understand the political backdrop to the situation. These charges are coming straight from the top, from Governor Kemp.
That's what you feel. That's what you feel. That's what you feel. Do you all have evidence of that?
Well, we can see it. I mean, of course, it's impossible to read the mind of Governor Kemp or the mind of prosecutors. So nobody can say for sure, right? But we can see it in every indication of the way that Kemp has approached the situation. He wasted no time in issuing a statement immediately after these arrests, as well as every other series of arrests that are connected to the movement against Cop City, eagerly posturing, trying to present these arrests as an example of his sort of tough on crime, tough on the left sort of image. And it's very clear that he's using this as a political opportunity to posture for his presidential campaign, because he knows that in order to play to his right-wing base, he needs to demonstrate to them that he's tougher on the left than Trump is, right? He has to out-Trump Trump.
Okay, I want to get this in.
This is just...
Okay, I got you. I think folks understand, but I want to be able to get some questions in, because part of the public response to this raid and the arrests include statements from Georgia's congressional delegation, Senators Raphael Warnock and John Ossoff. Both had largely avoided comment on the training center up until this point as it relates to your arrest along with your fellow members there as well. Dr. Bernice King made a mention of the arrest during a King Center live stream last night. I want you to take a listen to this.
I want to encourage those who are continuing to fight this fight. As difficult as it seems, violence is never the answer. And I get it. The argument always comes back to us, but why don't you speak against the violence of the state? We're speaking to all of the violence. The what they did on Wednesday with that raid, that was violent, to take in a SWAT team based off of some allegations of charitable fraud and other things like that.
What do you make of that?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's very astute. I've never heard of a SWAT team being used based on charges like this before. And I think it's clear, like I said, that the true reason behind this type of force is a theatrical one. It's designed to intimidate, and it's designed to send a message really to all left grassroots organizers that they are in danger in this state if they go against the agenda of Governor Kemp.
Okay. As we begin to wrap up, what is next for you all and what you can tell us? Do you have another court date? Is there a hearing? What's happening?
Well, I mean, we eagerly await the opportunity to confront these charges in court because we know that they're baseless. That could be a long time from now. But in the meantime, we're absolutely going to continue the work that we do as the Atlanta Solidarity Fund to, defend activists who are targeted for protesting.
How are you doing personally?
I'm doing a lot better than I was last week. I'm taking it one day at a time and, trying to make sure that this type of violence doesn't befall anybody else in the city, even though it already has to me.
Marlon Kaut is an organizer with the Atlanta Solidarity Fund. He was one of the three that was arrested in that raid last week. Marlon, we appreciate you taking the time. Thank you so much.
Thank you for talking with me.
And Closer Look continues now from WABE in Atlanta. I'm Rose Scott. Now, in that last segment, we played a clip with Dr. Bernice King yesterday in response to the Atlanta City Council's vote to provide funding for fire and police training. You heard a little bit of that. Here's also what she said.
What pained me about it was not just how they voted. What really pained me was that this was the second time in 3 weeks that people came before the city council. Not everybody, let me be clear. There were some people there that were not speaking the language of nonviolence and dignity, but the majority of the people who came before came with facts in hand. They came not just with emotion, they came with reason and they came with passion. Some even ended by saying, I love you, And at the end of the day, it was as if we're just going to do this so we can check it off the list and say we had a listening session with the citizens. That's not what people want. That's placating.
King, of course, is CEO of the Martin Luther King Jr. Center for Nonviolent Social Change, and of course, the daughter of Coretta and the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Nearly 15 hours of public comment that began on Monday and ended early Tuesday morning. Of course, the vote was 11-4 in favor of the funding legislation. That includes from Councilmember Matt Westmoreland, who holds the post to a large seat on the council, and he joins me now. Councilmember Westmoreland, thanks for taking time. I appreciate it. You get rested? You rested up?
Yeah, I am rested up, and I appreciate the invitation. It's good to be back, Rose.
And we should note that we are reaching out to every council member, and they can either decline or come on the program, so we appreciate you.
Absolutely.
Let's begin here. I want to get your thoughts on what Bernice King had to say regarding all of this leading up to that vote.
Sure. Now, well, I also heard from Reverend King on Monday during the meeting. And
she called you?
Yeah, she reached out. And I'll say, you know, as someone who sat through the entirety of the public comment, both in this meeting and, you know, you and I have talked about this topic 2 years ago when the last council took the first vote on this project and kind of my thought process on how I got to my vote on that one. It's absolutely true. We heard from hundreds of folks on Monday and into Tuesday morning. I've also heard from hundreds of residents on both sides of this issue through emails, through phone calls, at neighborhood events as recently as this past weekend. So I think it is fair to say that there are a lot of opinions on this issue, and I want to stress that they are on both sides. So it's absolutely true. The vast, vast majority of the public comment in the room on Monday was very passionate and outspoken opposition, and I completely respect that. And I've heard a lot from residents who feel just the opposite.
She said, and I'm quoting her, there was no dignity in this process. In other words, after hearing not only just during this last council meeting, but whether it was the 17 hours of the recorded public comment because of the pandemic and then another almost 9 hours. At any point, Councilmember Westmoreland, during any of this time, did you consider not voting in favor of this?
Sure. So I think, you know, when I came in and spoke with you back in September of 2021, we talked about kind of my thinking and my thought process and the different stakeholder groups that were at play. And I really did wrestle back 2 years ago with this vote. And I view the vote in September of 2021 as that was the decision on whether to do this project or not, right? To enter into the work that has been done.
Under Mayor Bottoms' administration.
That's right. Yeah, yeah. No, this came from during the Bottoms administration, and it was a 10-4 vote back in September of 2021 after many, many hours of, to your point, virtual public comment. And I wrestled with that issue, and I laid out all of the facts, and I talked with my colleagues, and I heard from constituents, and I voted in favor of the project. And, you know, this piece of legislation addresses the public funding, which I suspect we'll get to in a little bit. But, you know, when you think about the community stakeholder advisory group that has met monthly over the last stretch of period of time and the work that's gone into preparing the site for the construction of the training center, you know, this vote itself was literally for the public funding. And I think that that's important to acknowledge.
So let's talk about the funding.
Sure.
Because as we've been hearing, it was just going to be $30 million. $30 million, one-third of the alleged $90
million. Mm-hmm.
And the Atlanta Police Foundation would kick in the rest. Now we know through some reporting and open records requests, it is going to cost potentially double than that for the city to kick in, which is taxpayer money. But still you...
And 10 of my colleagues voted in favor.
Okay,
sure.
I'm not talking about them.
Yeah,
I'm talking
about
you.
No, that's right.
Because you're here.
That's right.
They're not here. Now, when they get here, I'll ask them. But
sure.
I'm asking you.
Yeah, no, I will stand.
That's not problematic to you?
I will stand. So here, I appreciate the question because I think it's important for folks to understand my thought process, at least, and perhaps others. So the legislation that we adopted on Tuesday morning does authorize the CFO to allocate up to $30 million. That'll probably be in two kind of tranches of $15 million each. And then the second piece of that, we are currently paying $1.4 million a year to rent space for our public safety officials to train in various places around the state, really. Part of the training has to take place an hour and a half away. And so under the agreement we passed Tuesday, we will be spending $1.2 million a year over the next 30 years. And so I view it, we are making a $30 million investment. That's the money that we allocated to the CFO he can authorize. And then the second piece is we will be spending $200,000 less a year to use this facility, which will be ours forever, as opposed to spending $1.4 million a year to rent other people's facilities that are either inadequate or far away. And to me, I think that makes financial sense.
You say it makes financial sense because you're looking at what the city is spending
today.
Today.
And last year and the year before.
But the opposition to this facility, a big part of the opposition to the facility, is that it's going to be built where it's going to be built in this community. That's a big part of the opposition.
I think, yeah. So part of what made this so challenging a couple of years ago was just how many different stakeholder groups there are, from first responders to, you know, residents who live in Southeast Atlanta versus who, where you hear a significant amount of the opposition. Residents who live in other parts of the city who I interact with as a citywide official are very much in support of this project. And you've got
criminal justice. Yeah, but if it was in their neighborhood, do you think they'd be in support of it?
Well, so I think...
You live in Morningside, right?
I live in Midtown. I grew up in Morningside.
Right.
I think if... I have been to this site many times.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the amendments that I authored to the original paper back in 2021 was to create the Community Stakeholder Advisory Group, mm-hmm. which brought together neighborhood association presidents of the neighborhoods in DeKalb County that are nearby and the City of Atlanta neighborhoods that are right across Moreland Avenue.
Mm-hmm.
And that group met monthly, and they came back each time they would meet with different requests and recommendations. Every single one of the 15 requests is a part of this plan. They have made the site design significantly better. And I think that if you, you know, when I talk to residents on both sides of Moreland, either in Atlanta or in DeKalb, I'm grateful for the recommendations they made. They have made the site significantly better. And I truly believe at the end of this process, we're going to have a training center that we need for our first responders to train better. And I'd like to talk a little bit about curriculum and training at the appropriate time. But then the other piece of this is the 100,000 tires we've pulled off this site over the last several months and the invasive species that need to be removed from the acres that we own and the hardwood trees. We've preserved all the hardwood trees on this site. There are plans to build hundreds more, lay trails, and open it up to the public, almost 300 acres of publicly accessible green space. If you put all of that together, I think that is a good thing for Atlanta and for the surrounding residents on both sides of the county line.
That's what you think.
Yes.
But as you just said, you've heard overwhelmingly, and you admitted that even with its public comment, that folks do not want it in that neighborhood.
I have heard the public comment has been overwhelmingly opposed in public meetings.
And from environmental to just the optics around, and you know, Councilman Westmoreland, because we've had these issues before. The optics around policing in black and brown communities. I've never met anyone that has said, oh, I don't want the police to show up in my neighborhood when something is happening.
Mm-hmm.
But the optics around this facility on this land, for some, it's very sacred, the history of this land. And Atlanta has a lot of land around.
Let's talk about this piece of property. So the city has owned this piece of property for the better part of a century. And since 1974, pieces of this property have been used for various aspects of mm-hmm. training. There is currently a firing range on this site that we're using, and we're one of the 15 recommendations from the Community Stakeholder Advisory Committee was to move that range away from the houses that it is currently very close to. And so I agree. But much of the public comment we heard on Monday and Tuesday, and we can go back, I didn't keep a tally, is opposed to the construction of a training center anywhere. A lot of the public comment is opposed to police, period, in the police department and our police officers. And so there are a lot of different subgroups of folks who are opposed. And I think that's important to call out. And then the last thing I want to say is I have heard from a lot of residents who support this project, in this location, who have seen the investments that we're going to make in the center, and then all of the surrounding green space that will connect to other parks in DeKalb County. It is absolutely true. Most of the folks, almost all of the folks in the room on Monday, were very much opposed. I think they were opposed to it anywhere. But you're right. There is a segment that would be supportive of a training center, not just in this site. And it's just a complicated pieces of the puzzle.
Can y'all not use the money to renovate the old police and fire training location?
So part of the conversation here is that we've got our old police facility has been condemned and can't be used by people. And so we're currently renting space at Atlanta Metropolitan College that we don't own. And then the fire folks have been having to rent different places as well to do our driving part of training. We have to go down to Forsyth, Georgia.
If it's been condemned, can't you just knock it down? You have knock it down and build something new there. Can't you
right.
do that?
So if the goal, if you think back to 2 years ago, if the goal is to put all of our first responders together so that they can benefit from the opportunity to train together, which we see our police and firefighters working more and more when emergencies arise, you know, to put police and fire together. And I want to go back to the driving piece to lay out the, you know, the state has regulations for how courses need to look and how big they need to be, right? And so if you want to put all of those things together, you need a piece of land that is sizable enough.
Would
to
you
make
want
that
to live
happen.
Next to something like this? I'm curious.
Would I? Sure. Yes. I would be okay living next to something like this. And I think, but I don't, which is why it's been important for me to listen to the folks who do and who have requested things like a 100-foot tree buffer or the noise mitigation strategies that we've moved into this, or the we moved the entrance to the whole project to a different road at their request. And I think when I talk to residents nearby, I hear their requests, the parking that we're going to put to make sure that folks aren't parking on people's streets.
So those are folks that are in favor of this?
No, they're folks who live next door.
Okay, but and those are some of the folks who said it's okay as long as you do this, that, and the third. But they didn't show up Monday and Tuesday, huh?
They did not.
Yeah. Here's what your fellow council member Keisha Shawn Waits told WABE's Lisa Ram yesterday.
You have nearly 1,000 people who stayed up all night long. Lisa, I've never seen this. I've been engaged in this process for nearly 2 decades. I served as a former state representative where I've been at the state capitol until midnight many times. I have never seen the type of engagement, the type of commitment where people stayed all night long to make sure that their voice was on record. And I believe to be insulted, we could have at least sent it back to committee to have gotten this right. We could have at least sent it back to committee to give us more time to answer some of the unanswered questions, to make sure that this was properly vetted.
Now, that motion, I believe, was carried forward by Councilmember Alex Wan. I think it was seconded by Liliana Bakhtiari. You voted no. I believe Councilmember Waits voted no, too.
Yeah, I was going to say it was
very interesting.
Yeah, to your point about playing that clip, yeah, it was an 11 different people voted in favor of sending it back to committee. It was a 4-11 vote. And then it was
which was interesting
different.
Because in different from people who voted
that's right
for and against. So, yeah. But what does it say to you, though?
So a couple of things. One, I, too, just like Keisha, have the meeting, the length of the meeting, the intensity of the pain that I heard from a lot of folks who have had really scarring experiences with law enforcement was something that I took away from that. The intensity of the passion, I would never pretend to not acknowledge how intense the passion was in that room on Monday. When I look at putting forward the dollars, the $30 million that has been talked about for the last 2 years of public funding for this project, like that was the question on the table at the time. And I, go ahead.
Okay, so, because I want to be fair to you, you're saying that in that moment, you're thinking about let's focus on this piece of legislation, although you wrestled with it 2 years ago, but you voted in favor of it. So now you're wrestling with the legislation at the moment. But let me ask you this, Councilmember Westmoreland, because was it misleading then to the public? Because you all kept saying $30 million. It's going to be $67 million. Was that not enough to say, well, maybe we need to send this back to committee and do a little bit more vetting, as Councilmember Waite suggested?
So that topic came up a lot, sending it back to committee. And I know this is your show, so you get to ask the questions. But I have asked people who have suggested that, because a lot of people say send it back to committee, and I would always say, to what end? Like, what is the goal in that? And most often when I heard the answer earlier this week, it was we don't want to build this anywhere, right? And I just fundamentally disagree with that. I think we need a training center, and we had a very long conversation 2 years ago about building one and building it here, and I think the proposal has gotten significantly better.
But the motion was
years.
About funding, and
that's
you
right.
And you've been saying, I'm in that moment, Rose, I'm focusing on the legislation
that's
to fund
me.
It,
yeah, yeah, right.
Not whether or not it should be built, because you've already made your vote
made that
some
years
ago.
Right.
So this is about funding.
Yep.
So you kind of contradict yourself there if you're saying you didn't feel in that moment, since we're talking about funding, this was a funding related motion, but you voted against it.
To send it back to committee?
Yeah, for more vetting.
And I'm saying the paper in front of us authorized the CFO to allocate up to $30 million.
But it's going to cost more than that.
But it's going to cost less than we're spending this year and last year and the year before.
Can you understand if someone...
Do I understand where people are coming from? Yes. Okay. I think we can level set there. Yes. I think when I was on the school board...
I remember those days.
Right? When I was on the school board, we used to have a saying, people can grieve the outcome, but they shouldn't be able to grieve the process.
And if, why not?
Because you want to run a tight process.
Well,
right?
But process, and you know the history of this nation, process hasn't always been fair.
That's my point. Let me rephrase it.
Yeah, you might want to clean that up.
Sure. So the quote that we used to always say was, people might grieve the vote that you take at the end, but don't let them grieve the process that you used to get public input to explain the situation, right? That I think, in this situation, this topic, there have been many process problems. And so that's the point I was trying to get to, is that...
So you acknowledge there's been a lot of problems in the process.
Without question. So since the beginning of the introduction June of 2021.
To that, again, you still didn't think, well, maybe we should rethink some of the issues with the process?
No, I will be the first person, but certainly not the only one, to acknowledge that since the original legislation to do this project was introduced in June of 2021, there have been issues with the process. And I think that those issues have continued. You know, there have been issues in the past and there have been issues recently. So my point is that I understand people have been really frustrated with the process or with the communication or lack of communication. So that I wholeheartedly agree with. But the question in front of us around allocating the public funding that we have been talking about was the thing in front of us. And I guess what I'm not fully understanding is that I heard from folks send it back. Well, what I really heard was vote it down. That was the loud message on Monday and Tuesday, was just vote it down. We don't want this. And I'm saying, I disagree with that. We need a training center. And we have been working on this site for the last 2 years, and we've been working with the community to make the site design better. And that, you know, Councilman Dozier is a really dear friend of mine, and we talk a lot about
who
this
voted
thing.
No against.
That's right, yeah.
And
as did Liliana, right. And I think he's coming.
Right, he'll be on the show. I think both of them are coming tomorrow.
So. Good. And one of the things that Jason and I talk a lot about is this being a policy disagreement, right? And I think that I love that they're going to come and talk to you tomorrow, because they've been...
But it seems like y'all should be talking to each other.
Oh, and we do, every day, all day. But that's my point, is that I voted yes. Jason and Liliana both voted no, because this is, to the three of us, a policy disagreement, and that some of us vote yes and some of us vote no.
But, and again, I want to be very clear.
Yeah.
Because someone will send me an email and say that I wasn't fair. You have been telling me in this conversation... You wrestled with the decision back in 2021.
I did.
There have been problems with the process up to that early morning Tuesday vote.
Mm-hmm.
But it wasn't enough for you
to vote no on public funding?
Well, because you've admitted there have been issues.
Sure.
If there are issues, why continue to support something if there are issues? Can you understand someone with that thought process?
I think I can. And I would acknowledge that there have been issues with the process. But that's kind of what I meant between the difference between process and the outcome. And the outcome is that this city needs a training center. And part of the outcome of this one is going to be the removal of invasive species and the opening up of almost 300 acres of green space to the public for the first time ever. So that's the outcome. I agree there have been problems with the process. But I also agree that 2 years ago, this city and the council voted to build this center at this site. And there was a piece of public money that is needed for that project, and that's the vote we took on Tuesday.
That's the vote you took on Tuesday. That's understandable. Now comes this referendum. You've heard about this.
I have.
According to the legal folks we've spoken to, and we think our legal, you know,
folks are probably pretty good. Yeah,
they're pretty good. This has a lot of meat to it.
Yeah. Now I heard a little bit about the concept of a referendum on Monday afternoon at City Hall, and obviously there was a press conference, I believe, today. So I don't know a whole lot about the mechanics, frankly. Something that I'll be digging into as well, the state law that's behind it.
I think there's going to be 60 days where you can get
75,000 signatures.
A percentage of signatures, yeah.
And then part of the question is also literally what the wording is. Like,
sure.
What is the request being made, right? And so there's a lot for all of us to learn about that process. And, you know, that is literally, in its purest form, direct democracy. The voters of Atlanta, all of them that come to the ballot box, making their voice heard on a topic. Go ahead.
Only because we're up against time, and we have the city of Doorville.
I know, the arts public art. Yeah.
I want to give them their time.
Yep.
Throughout this process, would you have done anything differently?
Without question is kind of the broad answer to that. Would I have personally done anything differently?
Or asked?
Yeah.
Or sought?
The short answer to that is yes.
Like what?
I know. I was going to say I'd have to spend some time thinking about. I think I often hear from residents who say, you know, why are you bulldozing 400 acres of an old growth forest to build a helicopter landing pad and explosion detonation unit to train 45% of the nation's police departments? Because those are different pieces of information that are out there. None of those four things are true. And so I think what has been frustrating in all of this is there's been, and what I have always said is I totally respect folks who are opposed to either the site or to, I understand people who are opposed to the whole training center, even though I disagree with that. But when folks are opposed to the development of an 85-acre training center on this site and all the other pieces that come with it, I respect that. What I have felt and seen and heard a lot of over the last couple of years is there are a lot of people who are opposed to things that we aren't doing. Like, there are no explosive detonation sites on this property. There are no helicopters. The development is going to be 85 acres. Mm-hmm. It's actually going to be less. And there are a series of amendments we added to the paper on Tuesday before we passed it. But like the specific answer to your question is the city clearly did not do a good job of explaining exactly what is and is not happening. And there's been a lot of attempts, the amendments on Tuesday were part of them, to clarify what we're actually doing. And if folks are opposed to that, I totally respect it.
Because some would say it's a little late. So
That's right. You asked what we do differently, and the answer is it is late.
And just real quickly, before this segment, you know, I spoke with one of the three members who were involved in that raid and that was arrested last week.
Yeah.
Through your lens, you haven't commented on that publicly. Your thoughts on that?
Extremely concerning. I saw Reverend Warnock's post about it on social media, and I thought he captured it very well. What happened, and the information is still coming out, but what we know so far, it's extremely troubling. And I heard your earlier guest, and I can only imagine what that must have been like, and there are a lot of issues that I see with it.
Do you agree with the guest that perhaps this was orchestrated from top, from Governor Brian Kemp and Attorney General Chris Carr?
I know where it didn't come from, which is the seat that I sit in, and I've heard those same things too. I don't know all of the information, and I don't want to speculate, but I will say I didn't know about the raid, the show of force, until after it happened. But as I have learned more about it, I'm very concerned.
Atlanta City Councilman Matt Westmoreland, thank you so much for taking time. I appreciate it. Good to see you again.
Good to be back.
And Closer Look continues from WABE in Atlanta. I'm Rose Scott. We're going to go back to the late 1970s, early 80s, where we're leaving disco and sappy heartache, soft rock music, although I do like the group Bread. And we're going to enter, you know, glam metal and more uptown funk and contemporary R&B. But there was something else taking place closer to home. The city of Doraville was becoming home for a small influx of immigrants. And often, as we hear from some of the city's historians, they say that these residents would paint and decorate their businesses with art reflective of their home countries and cultures. But apparently that did not sit well with then the city's commissioners at the time, and an ordinance was enacted banning public art. Well, it would take till 2017, and leaders began working with local artists to reverse the ordinance, which they did. And we want to know, like, how all this happened. So joining me now, I have Sarah Marks, Director of the Doraville Art Center and President of Doraville Art Incorporated. I'm also joined by Mary French, the Operations Director and Treasurer for the Doraville Art Center. Welcome.
Hi. Thank you.
Thank you.
I know you all weren't on the commission back then, or were you? You weren't. Okay. But any idea, like, why did they want to ban public art? Was it through your lens?
Well, I, my father, the house I live in right now, my father bought it in 1976. And the immigration population that was coming in, there was just a very large backlash. And I think that they had an overreaction, extreme overreaction.
Sounds which, biased. If not,
it absolutely
yeah.
was.
Yeah.
It absolutely was. And so when, and I've been living in Doraville for 32 years, and I have been trying desperately to get an art scene going, but of course it's very difficult to get an art scene going when you're not allowed to have art anywhere outside, you know, inside the city.
And I want to be clear for our listeners, because they're saying, wait a minute, you're telling us that for decades, public art was not allowed in Doraville.
It was completely against the local municipal codes to have murals, sculptures, any of those sort of items in the public space.
So even fountains.
No public art.
Because let's be clear, Atlanta, great public art everywhere. Murals, we have some great, awesome creatives. And in Doraville, nothing.
Yep, that was absolutely the case. And so when we started to form Doraville Art, which is a nonprofit, mm-hmm. We wanted the really critical piece was that we wanted the art that was going to come to reflect Doraville, mm-hmm. which is extremely multicultural. Mm-hmm. And it is within the city of Atlanta, it's entirely novel. And so we've really got, now that the ordinance is reversed, which is when we started, it was 2019, and just before the pandemic, and we had one event. Go ahead.
Wow. No, I marveled.
We had one event, and so then the pandemic hit, and we couldn't do anything. And so during that time, we were all having really hard conversations with city council members saying, how are we going to do public art in a place that doesn't have any? Yeah. We're not allowed to put stuff up, so let's get this changed.
How you're all able to convince, and I imagine the mindset of the commissioners had changed too. And
luckily at that point, the council and even city staff, they were all completely on board with, how do we get this done? How do we make these changes? So the city created an art commission, as cities will do. And luckily, Sarah was able to sit on that commission from the beginning in changing municipal code, which is not a fun job for anybody, but it was worth every minute to change code.
So, Sarah, you're convincing elected officials, in a sense, they are elected, about the importance of public art.
Yes. And fortunately, I like to talk long and enthusiastically about this particular matter, which is why I think they let me get on there. But they were very sorry when they did, I think, because we were having a lot of difficult conversations. I was the only artist on the commission. And so, you know, we had to explain things. I was a working artist for a very, very long while. Well, I still am a working mm-hmm. artist. And, you know, we had to have conversations about, you know, well, why can't we have an event where somebody gives us their art and then they get exposure? And we like to say, you know, artists die of exposure. That's not a good, artists need to be paid for their work. And that's one of our important parts of our mission, is that artists get paid with Doraville art.
So let's move to the happiness of this.
Yes.
How is the city of Doraville now? You have a Doraville Art Center. You probably have a lot of artists who are flourishing and thriving, whether through exposure or just to be in a city where people appreciate your creativity. And it can beautify a city, let's be clear.
As soon as, I want to say 1 month after the ordinances were changed, we put a 9-foot-tall Tyrannosaurus Rex sculpture painted by a local mural artist into one of our parks.
Which, I always start with the dinosaurs.
Like, go big.
From the beginning.
Go big or go home. And we had a community event where the children of Doraville named our dinosaur. They named her Dora. They did. And she just had her third birthday.
She did.
Third birthday. Uh-huh. So that was a great one. And then we've been working with the city on various mural projects, including an art walk.
Right. Wow. So it's going to be an art walk that spans the entire length of the city, 2.6 miles, and end-to-end murals.
And how does it look to you all just seeing this?
It's so exciting. I I can't even tell you how excited I am. I believe that art changes people's lives for the better. It improves not only environments, but kids who are exposed to art early do better in school. It saves lives. Art saves lives. And I know that sounds overly dramatic, but it's true.
I actually have a listener with an email that says, we all have art programs for kids.
We actually are getting ready to, in partnership with the City of Doraville Parks and Recreation Summer Camp, we will be having classes for those summer camp students in the City of Doraville on I think it's mostly now on Fridays. We'll have some other ones. And then during the summer, we do classes that are good for kids of all ages, as I like to say. So you can come in with, we've had some beautiful tie-dyes and acrylic pours done by five-year-olds.
You've got a piece of an acrylic pour.
I love tie-dyes. I worked at a summer camp, and we made everything from candles to tie-dye shirts to friendship bracelets. Yeah, I know I'm getting very sappy. That's what I do because I love art as well. What is it going to mean to be able to now, for kids and even some other older residents, to know that this is part of the fabric for the City of Doraville after so many decades of not having this?
Well, one of the things that we say at the Art Center is, you know, you can come to the Art Center and you can learn how to do art, but also it's a community center. We want people to come and be a community and to bring their culture and have it interpret and affect what we're doing. And we love that. It's coming up so beautifully the way it's working with Doraville.
And Mary, I'll give you the last word, what it means to have this part of the fabric.
The fabric is also getting to work with other nonprofits in our area. So we have a current show getting ready to come up with Doraville Pride, themed transitions, a universal theme, but really supports Pride. We've worked with We Love Buford Highway on our current show Home. We worked with Raksha on a show about I Am and all of the points of being a woman. So it's amazing to just have all of these community people come together and express their voice and let everyone else hear it.
Our website is translated into 7 languages.
Can I get my picture in front of the dinosaur?
Absolutely.
That would be really cool. Mary French, the Operations Director and Treasurer for the Doraville Art Center. I was also joined by Sarah Marks, Director of the Doraville Art Center, President of Doraville Art Incorporated. Thank you both for coming in and taking the time. I'm glad you all have your artwork.
Thank you, Russ.
Public art. And that's it for this edition of Closer Look, which is produced by LaShawn Hudson and Daniel Razel and Tiffany Griffith, our engineer, Sonya Vanderwerth. A reminder to let us know your thoughts on today's program or any other. Send me an email, rose@wabe.org. And if you missed any of today's program, it's online at wabe.org/closerlook. And of course, Closer Look weeknights at 7 p.m. as well as in our podcast. So subscribe to Closer Look wherever you like. Don't worry. Fresh Air with Terry Gross is coming up next. Also want to invite you to join Closer Look Live next Friday at the Atlanta History Center for our Juneteenth. It's called Words and Beats. It's all about storytelling. It's next Friday at the Atlanta History Center Live, Closer Look. Stay tuned to 90.1 WABE Atlanta. I'm Rose Scott.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
The Gold Dome Scramble podcast is now plugged in, a WAB politics podcast. New name, same in-depth, on-the-ground reporting from us, WAB politics reporters Sam Greenglass and Raul Bally. We'll cover local, state, and national politics as we go beyond the headlines with journalists, voters, and politicians. New episodes drop Fridays starting April 26th. Listen and subscribe at WAB.org or your favorite podcast platform.